Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hi, I'm continuing the Midland Reporter Telegram for August 12, 2023. In commentary, Football Stadium at Sports Complex is the City's Responsibility by Stuart Dream. The football soccer stadium at the Scarborough Sports Complex is the City of Midland's, and that is how it needs to stay. In 1999, Midlanders overwhelmingly voted to build a dual stadium facility in West Midland. The construction would be paid for by an addition to the city's sales tax, and the city would take care of the operations. Nearly 25 years later, we know the Scarborough Sports Complex runs at $2 million a year deficit, according to city officials. There are reasons for the deficits. We built a football, soccer stadium, and baseball stadium that was bigger than what we actually needed. Sellouts are not a common occurrence. The City of Midland also entered into contracts with Midland ISD and the Midland Rockhounds that were tenant-friendly. Recently, the Reporter Telegram reported that the City of Midland has had ongoing discussions with Midland ISD about taking over the football, soccer stadium. There is logic in that for both sides. The city, of course, wants someone else to carry some of the burden on operating the complex, and Midland ISD is the primary user of the football-soccer stadium. The negatives, however, outweigh the positives. Midland ISD doesn't need to be in the stadium operating business. The school district has enough older facilities to worry about. In fact, there is likely bond proposition in November that will designate $207.5 million for deferred maintenance and aging facilities. My expectations are Midland ISD also doesn't have the staffing in-house to operate and market the football-soccer stadium at the sports complex. Our school district should focus its human capital on student outcomes and not lining up events at the football-soccer stadium. Here's the deal. The Scarborough Sports Complex, like the Horseshoe Complex, wasn't built to make money. It was built to allow for events to take place that could help local tourism and quality of life. We have to accept the fact that both complexes will run at a deficit every year. We have to expect the Scarborough Sports Complex is grander than we probably needed. On Thursday, Midland ISD ended the debate, hopefully, when it sent out a late afternoon press release that stated, MISD is not interested in taking ownership of the Eastown Broadband Stadium and intends on continuing to rent the stadium from the city, as it has done for more than 20 years. If those words hold true, it will be one of the best decisions Stephanie Howard has made in her time as Midland ISD superintendent. It shows a focus on what Midland ISD needs to do rather than what someone might want to do. We do need Midland ISD and the Midland Rockhounds to pay the city more. The City of Midland also needs to see if funds like hotel and motel tax funds can be used to help put a dent in the yearly deficit. There likely isn't an organization or facility in Midland that brings in as many people from Odessa, from around the Permian Basin, and around West Texas as the Scarborough Sports Complex. Whereas city leaders have avoided raiding that fund in the past, it is a preferable option to giving the facility to another taxing entity or raising our property taxes to pay for operations. Maybe the city can be resourceful for using those facilities on a regular basis. Maybe it is time to put a ticket surcharge or require those using the baseball or football soccer stadium to start paying the city for parking. There isn't a fairer way to pay for operations or maintenance than asking those using the stadium to pay for its upkeep. Hi, I'm continuing the Midland Reporter Telegram for August 12, 2023. Midland ISD bond question. Is too much at one time an issue? Conversation continues about going for so much at one time by Stuart Doreen. The debate about a $1.4 billion Midland ISD school bond will continue next week, and one topic that will be talked about is how much can the board really expect voters to approve? Board members talked about this Thursday night during a school board bond meeting at Bunch Elementary with some questioning if a scaled-back bond is the best way to get two high schools approved. Patrick Payton talked to the Reporter Telegram this week about the pace of the community's bond conversation, and he said his hope is the district will hit the pause button for a minute and take the next year to really think about what the bond planning committee has said. Maybe we can start asking our city for investment in this over the long haul rather than just one big, huge ask, Payton said. I think that's what the voters want. Payton didn't talk to the Reporter Telegram as the former leader of one of the largest churches in Midland, Stonegate Fellowship, or as a former mayor. He is working with industry leaders on the Permian Progress, a 501(c)(4) that, unlike a 501(c)(3), will be involved in a data collection and will be involved politically. The C4 has already participated in polling that Peyton says helps the organization see where the community is and has shared that data with Midland ISD. The data, he said, stated voters were, by a long shot, in favor of multiple bonds over a series of years that helps Midland get out the indebtedness to our facilities over time, rather than thinking we're just going to do this all in one shot. The Reporter-Telegram reached out to Midland ISD Board President Tommy Bishop, who emailed that the recommendations presented by the Bond Planning Committee hold significant weight in guiding his perspective. I value and appreciate the committee's dedications, hard work, and analysis of this project that will greatly impact the students in the community, he wrote. He also responded to a question about using a longer approach when it comes to bonds instead of one large bond by saying the projected growth of Midland and increase of students is also a major factor. We are so far behind in addressing the needs of our facilities as they relate to growth, and we don't have time to waste, Bishop wrote. It is critical to strike a balance between addressing immediate needs while ensuring we are prepared for future MISD growth. I am also mindful of the upcoming changes in tax rate structure. With the maintenance and operations M&O tax rate expected to fall due to the state's effort to provide tax relief to homeowners, there is potential for tax rates to remain flat even with the passage of the bond. This is a unique opportunity that we need to take advantage of. Peyton has experience with elections, even beyond his mayoral victory in 2019. He was the co-chair of the election campaign to pass the $163 million elementary school bond in 2012. To date, that remains the largest successful bond election, no matter the entity, in Midland's history. Peyton compared Midland ISD's facility situation to being in credit card debt and that it can't get out of debt with a consolidation loan, but just start taking baby steps. There's a way to get this community behind it, Peyton said. It's going to take 10 years, it's going to take 15 years, it's going to take long to get where we need with the facilities. An ulterior motive. Peyton told the Reporter-Telegram that the community supports Superintendent Stephanie Howard. I think she's the best shot we've had in a long time. I hope she hears the support that she has behind her to not get in a big hurry on this bond, and let's maybe do a couple of bonds. He also told the Reporter-Telegram that a well-respected leader will choose to take serious matters slower and that they risk losing influence if they choose to take up a serious matter too fast. Peyton and members of the C4 have met with Howard and board leaders about their polling, which also states Midlanders favor more than two comprehensive high schools. Hi, I'm continuing the Midland Reporter Telegram for August 12, 2023. Biz Buzz. Occasions Fine Jewelry named one of America's coolest jewelry stores by Ben Schaffer. The Midland jewelry store Occasions Fine Jewelry was named one of America's coolest jewelry stores by InStore Magazine, according to a press release from Occasions. Occasions won honorable mention, a top 8 finish in the Big Cool division for stores with several employees or more. The press release states that more than 80 stores took part in the 22nd annual contest that highlights the best examples of independent jewelry retailers in North America. Every year, we feel privileged to bring our readers the best of the best in our industry, said Tracy Shelton, InStore's editor-in-chief. We look for qualities like innovative marketing, top-notch client service, a creative retail environment, and a unique work culture. Stores are judged in exterior appearance, interior appearance, store biography, marketing, web presence, and overall individuality. The top 3 winners in 2 divisions, Small Cool and Big Cool, are featured in the September issue of InStore Magazine and at InStoreMagazine.com. Honorable mention stores will be featured as monthly cool stores in issues of InStore from October 2023 through July 2024, according to the press release. Hi, I am continuing the Midland Reporter Telegram for August 12, 2023. What to Know About Midland ISD's Bond Proposal by Stuart Doreen. On Thursday, Midland ISD board members met at Bunch Elementary, one of the 3 schools built thanks to the 2012 bond, to talk about the Midland ISD Bond Planning Committee's proposal. The following are highlights from the presentation delivered. What's the cost? The total cost of the proposal has dropped from $1.678 billion to $1.408 billion, not including interest, after consultants looked at the final proposal of the Midland ISD Bond Planning Committee. A 16% decrease was possible, officials said, because of cuts made to the bond programs, including eliminating redundancies and scaling back certain plans, specifically at the middle and high school campuses. Classroom capacity at each school would be reduced from 4,200 to 3,800 students. Propositions? The Bond Proposal Committee presented the bond with 2 proposals. Proposition A. 2 new high school campuses, $985.2 million, middle school renovations, $116.5 million, and safety, security, and accessibility, $50.4 million. Total, $1.151 billion. Proposal B, renovations to older facilities and deferred maintenance, $207.5 million, and a new elementary school in Northeast Midland, $48.5 million. Total, $256 million. Members of the Midland ISD board stated the building of two high schools was the number one priority and wanted the Midland ISD bond planning committee to look at bond scenarios that help with their passage. Scenarios thrown out on Thursday included putting all items on one proposition and doing away with items on Proposition B. The committee will talk about it Monday and provide its feedback to the board. Meetings this week. The Midland ISD Bond Planning Committee will meet at 6 p.m. Monday at the Legacy High School Library. The public is invited to attend. The next regular board meeting is scheduled for 5:30 p.m. Tuesday at the Bowie Fine Arts Academy Auditorium, 805 Elk Avenue. Midland ISD has previously reported that August 21st is the last day to call a bond election. Classrooms added. Officials said a benefit from the building of new high schools, the grade reconfiguration, and bond projects will be the addition of classrooms at the middle school, 6th through 8th grade campuses. The bond will help make 13 new classrooms at the current Midland freshman campus available. Other additions include 14 new classrooms at Goddard Junior High, 13 at Alamo Junior High, and 14 at Abel Junior High. Those facilities in San Jacinto Junior High and the current Legacy High School would become middle school campuses. Overall, 1,260 seats will be added at the high school level and 1,360 will be added at the middle school level. Pre-K additions. The bond program is expected to create 1,500 additional pre-K seats at campuses across Midland. That would help Midland, which has had a 95% of 3-year-olds missing pre-K opportunities and 33% of 4-year-olds missing pre-K opportunities during the 2021-22 school year, according to the Texas Education Agency. What about Midland High and Legacy freshmen? There are still no plans for what might be in store for those campuses or information provided that the facilities are salvageable. Tax rates. The following is the tax impact of the propositions A and B for a home valued at $341,046. After taking out current exemptions, the tax impact of a successful bond would be an additional $363 for Proposition A, $92 for Proposition B, or $455 combined. If the state homestead exemption increases to $100,000, the tax impact of a successful bond would be an additional $281 for Proposition A, $71 for Proposition B, or $353 combined. This year, the tax bill for the average home was $2,442. Board members also talked about changes to the interest and sinking INS tax rate next year that would allow the district to pay off all bond debt that the district currently faces. Stay tuned. Bond election assumptions. 4 equal annual issuances beginning summer 2024. 30-year amortization. 99% collection. 5.25 to 5.5% assumed future rates. Tax impact based on $45 billion taxable assessed valuation. Certified valuations for 2024 was around $49 billion. Existing debt profile. Midland ISD is still paying off debt from 4 different bonds. The amount of principal reported was $129.91 million. The district also reported a combined savings of $556.24 million from refunding and defeasances for the past 10 years. What about those indoor practice facilities? A big announcement from the presentation was the decrease in the amount of money required to build 2 100-yard indoor practice facilities/multipurpose facilities. Superintendent Stephanie Howard had told the Reporter-Telegram in July that the combined $77.4 million price tag seemed high, and she was right. The projects have been scaled back to cost $20 million each, or around $40 million, a 48.4% reduction. Hi, I am continuing the Midland Reporter-Telegram for August 12, 2023. What to Know About Midland ISD's Bond Proposal by Stuart Doreen. On Thursday, Midland ISD board members met at Bunch Elementary, one of the 3 schools built thanks to the 2012 bond, to talk about the Midland ISD Bond Planning Committee's proposal. The following are highlights from the presentation delivered. What's the cost? The total cost of the proposal has dropped from $1.678 billion to $1.408 billion, not including interest, after consultants looked at the final proposal of the Midland ISD Bond Planning Committee. A 16% decrease was possible, officials said, because of cuts made to the bond programs, including eliminating redundancies and scaling back certain plans, specifically at the middle and high school campuses. Classroom capacity at each school would be reduced from 4,200 to 3,800 students. Propositions? The Bond Proposal Committee presented the bond with two proposals. Proposition A. Two new high school campuses, $985.2 million. Middle school renovations, $116.5 million. And safety, security, and accessibility, $50.4 million. Total, $1.151 billion. Proposal B. Renovations to older facilities and deferred maintenance, $207.5 million, and a new elementary school in Northeast Midland, $48.5 million. Total, $256 million. Members of the Midland ISD board stated that building of two high schools was the number one priority and wanted the Midland ISD Bond Planning Committee to look at bond scenarios that help with their passage. Scenarios thrown out on Thursday included putting all items on one proposition and doing away with items on Proposition B. The committee will talk about it Monday and provide its feedback to the board. Meetings this week. The Midland ISD Bond Planning Committee will meet at 6 p.m. Monday at the Legacy High School Library. The public is invited to attend. The next regular board meeting is scheduled for 5:30 p.m. Tuesday at the Bowie Fine Arts Academy Auditorium, 805 Elk Avenue. Midland ISD has previously reported that August 21st is the last day to call a bond election. Classrooms added. Officials said a benefit from the building of new high schools, the grade reconfiguration, and bond projects will be the addition of classrooms at the middle school, 6th through 8th grade campuses. The bond will help make 13 new classrooms at the current Midland freshman campus available. Other additions include 14 new classrooms at Goddard Junior High, 13 at Alamo Junior High, and 14 at Abel Junior High. Those facilities in San Jacinto Junior High and the current Legacy High School would become middle school campuses. Overall, 1,260 seats will be added at the high school level and 1,360 will be added at the middle school level. Pre-K additions. The bond program is expected to create 1,500 additional pre-K seats at campuses across Midland. That would help Midland, which has had a 95% of 3-year-olds missing pre-K opportunities and 33% of 4-year-olds missing pre-K opportunities during the 2021-22 school year, according to the Texas Education Agency. What about Midland High and Legacy freshmen? There are still no plans for what might be in store for those campuses or information provided that the facilities are salvageable. Tax rates. The following is the tax impact of the propositions A and B for a home valued at $341,046. After taking out current exemptions, the tax impact of a successful bond would be an additional $363 for Proposition A, $92 for Proposition B, or $455 combined. If the state homestead exemption increases to $100,000, the tax impact of a successful bond would be an additional $281 for Proposition A, $71 for Proposition B, or $353 combined. This year, the tax bill for the average home was $2,442. Board members also talked about changes to the interest and sinking INS tax rate next year that would allow the district to pay off all bond debt that the district currently faces. Stay tuned. Bond election assumptions. 4 equal annual issuances beginning summer 2024. 30-year amortization. 99% collection. 5.25 to 5.5% assumed future rates. Tax impact based on $45 billion taxable assessed valuation. Certified valuations for 2024 was around $49 billion. Existing debt profile. Midland ISD is still paying off debt from 4 different bonds. The amount of principal reported was $129.91 million. The district also reported a combined savings of $556.24 million from refunding and defeasances for the past 10 years. What about those indoor practice facilities? A big announcement from the presentation was the decrease in the amount of money required to build two 100-yard indoor practice facilities/multi-purpose facilities. Superintendent Stephanie Howard had told the Reporter-Telegram in July that the combined $77.4 million price tag seemed high, and she was right. The projects have been scaled back to cost $20 million each, or around $40 million, a 48.4% reduction.
Barrels of drinking water for migrants walking through Texas have disappeared. Hebronville, Texas. As one of the worst heat waves on record set in across much of the southern United States this summer, authorities and activists in South Texas found themselves embroiled in a mystery in this arid region near the border with Mexico. Barrels of life-saving water that a human rights group had strategically placed for wayward migrants traveling on foot had vanished. Usually they are hard to miss, labeled with the word agua, painted in white, capital letters, and standing about waist high, the 55-gallon blue drums stand out against the scrub and grass, turned from green to a sun-dried brown. The stakes of solving this mystery are high. Summer temperatures can climb to 110 degrees Fahrenheit in Texas's sparsely populated Jim Hogg County, with its vast, inhospitable ranch lands. Migrants, and sometimes human smugglers, take a route through this county to try to circumvent a Border Patrol checkpoint on a busier highway about 30 miles to the east. More than 60 miles from the U.S.-Mexico border, it can take several days to walk there for migrants who may have already spent weeks crossing mountains and desert and avoiding cartel violence. "We don't have the luxury of losing time in what we do," said Ruben Garzas, an investigator with the Jim Hogg Sheriff's Office. Tears streamed down his face as he recalled helping locate a missing migrant man who became overheated in the brush, called for help, but died just moments after his rescue. Exact counts of those who die are difficult to determine because deaths often go unreported. The UN International Organization for Migration estimates almost 3,000 migrants have died crossing from Mexico to the U.S. by drowning in Rio Grande or because of lack of shelter, food, or water. Humanitarian groups started placing water for migrants in spots on the U.S. side of the border with Mexico in the 1990s after authorities began finding bodies of those who succumbed to the harsh conditions. John Meza volunteers with the South Texas Human Rights Center in Jim Hogg County, where the population of about 5,000 people is spread over 1,100 square miles, larger than the state of Rhode Island. He restocks the stations with gallons of jugs of water, trims away overgrown grass, and ensures the GPS coordinates are still visible on the underside of the barrel lids. On one of his rounds in July, Meza said 12 of the 21 stations he maintains were no longer there. The Associated Press compared images captured by Google Maps over the last 2 years and confirmed that some barrels that were once there were gone. Wildfires are common in this part of Texas, where dry grass quickly becomes fuel. Road construction crews frequently push or move aside obstructions for their work. But as Garza, the sheriff's investigator, walked along a path designated by GPS coordinates for the barrels, there were no signs of melted blue plastic, and nothing indicated the heavy barrels had been moved. Though volunteers fill them only part way, they can weigh up to 85 pounds. The investigator drove up and down the main highway where many of the water stations were installed near private property fence lines, making note of the circumstances of each missing barrel. Empty water bottles sat on the ground near the round impression left behind by the heavy barrel in one site. At another, the grass was trimmed and fresh earth was laid bare to create buffers against fire. Garza suspected state road crews moved three barrels that had been along an unpaved road, but the Texas Department of Transportation denied it. The investigator also noted a tremendous amount of wildfires could be to blame. He's also speaking with area ranchers in hopes of showing the disappearance may be a simple misunderstanding, not a crime. They probably have a logical explanation, he said, with no apparent lead. But in other states along the southern border, missing water stations have been ascribed to spiteful intentions. The group No More Deaths in 2018 released video of Border Patrol agents kicking over and pouring water out of gallon jugs left for people in the desert. No More Deaths said that from 2012 to 2015, it found more than 3,586 gallon jugs of water that had been destroyed in an 800-square-mile desert area in southern Arizona. Laura Hunter and her husband John started putting out water along popular smuggling routes in Southern California in the 1990s. They note that their effort is not affiliated with political or religious groups, but that their work is often attacked. Every single year, we have vandalism. Of course, you know, people that don't agree with what we do, Laura Hunter said. The Hunters met with Eddie Canales, the executive director of the South Texas Human Rights Center, about 15 years ago and provided the design for the low-cost water stations. In light of the news, they offered some advice. I would replace them all with some used barrels. Just replace them all, John Hunter said. And then I would put a couple of cameras on those and get the guy's license plates and his face. Canale said he plans to work with volunteers to replace the missing stations in the coming days. The number of migrants crossing through South Texas and subsequent deaths decreased this year after President Joe Biden's administration instituted new border policies. A medical examiner's office, who covers 11 counties, including Jim Hogg, has received the bodies of 85 migrants who died this year. It represents less than half the number sent to that office in 2022. Most of the migrants who died this year suffered fatal heat strokes. But that could change, especially if legal challenges to the Biden administration's policies are successful. For now, the mystery about the barrel's disappearance remains unsolved. But Mesa, the volunteer who restocks the barrels in Jim Hogg County, plans to continue his work. If that was intentional, that's a pretty malicious thing. You know what I mean? Mesa asked. You're saying, let these people die because I don't want to give them access to water. Ezekiel's astonishing story, still relevant. There is nothing else in the Bible like the story of the Valley of Dry Bones in Ezekiel 37, verses 1 through 14, where the prophet Ezekiel, whose book is full of startling visions, reveals the unlimited power of God. The Reverends Mario Martinez and Taylor Robles say the prophecy was revealed to give 10,000 Israelites guidance and hope during their exile 500 miles away in Babylon between 597 and 538 B.C. Ezekiel is one of the most difficult books because of its prophetic meanings, said Reverend Martinez, pastor of Genesis Christian Church. It is a special book because part of it was already fulfilled and part is still waiting to be fulfilled. What I get from the story of the Valley of Dry Bones is that when things seem hard for us, nothing is impossible with God. As parents, we see our children wander off and get lost in drugs or other addictions, and we think everything is over. Then God comes and gives life again. I don't see anything else like this in the Bible. Ezekiel himself is unique. He said he saw a vision, and when we say a vision, we don't necessarily mean it literally happened. However, the message is that God can do the impossible and bring Israel back to the Israelites. Martinez said another lesson in Ezekiel 37, 1 through 14, is that life is often terrifying for non-believers. It can be scary if we don't believe in God and are not close to Him, he said. Robel said a particularly striking aspect of the story is the complete reconstruction that God performs. When you look at the text, the bones are in this valley, and the Lord puts them back together, said Robles, minister of Sherwood Church of Christ. He says, hear the word of the Lord. Behold, I will cause breath to come into them, and they will have life. He begins to put them back together, tendons, muscles, and skin. But then there is a problem. They're still dead. So he breathes the spirit back into these dead bodies, and they become alive, stand up and become a vast army. Robel said there is a modern application in that many people are spiritually dead. It's interesting because when we look at people walking around in the world, they have skin on their bones and tendons, but they are still dead because they don't have the Spirit of God living inside them. He said, adding that the spiritually dead are exiled from life like the Israelites were exiled from their homeland because of their idolatry and other sins. It's terrible looking at the people right now who are in exile, he said. They have had preachers pleading with them to repent, but to no avail. Dallas developer starts construction at former Fairfield Lake State Park despite threat of land seizure. The wooden welcome sign and the brick columns at the front gate are gone. So is the green ticket office where visitors would buy entry passes for Fairfield Lake State Park. In their place is a poster with a rendering of a gated golf course community by Todd Interests, the park's new owner. The Dallas-based developer has begun construction at the former state park and is building roads at the site. Sean Todd, the company's founder and CEO, said the company is spending about $1 million a month on construction. Meanwhile, the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, whose commissioners voted in June to allow the agency to condemn the 5,000-acre property and seize it through eminent domain, is still holding out hope that Todd Interests will agree to sell the land to the state despite months of unsuccessful negotiation. Texas first learned the state park's future was in jeopardy when Texas Parks and Wildlife announced that the park in Freestone County, about 100 miles south of Dallas, was closing in February because it was on leased land and the owner was selling the property to Todd Interests. The agency has yet to file paperwork to initiate condemnation in court. I can't speak to what Todd is thinking at the moment, but I can say from our side that we would certainly like to come to an agreement and avoid having to move through the court process, says Corey Chandler, the agency's deputy communications director. As required by Texas law, TPWD said it sent Todd Interests 2 offer letters since commissioners gave the agency authority to use eminent domain. The final letter was sent August the 3rd, and the company had 2 weeks to respond. The agency did not disclose how much it offered for the land, but Chandler said it was not any less than fair market value. The state legislature appropriated $125 million earlier this year to the agency for park acquisition statewide. If the company doesn't agree to sell, Chandler said, TPWD would need to decide whether to move forward with condemnation. In an interview, Todd said his company purchased the land legally and he is not selling. The money appropriated for buying parks was from willing sellers, and we're not a willing seller, Todd said. Since the purchase, Todd has held several press conferences, including one in front of the Freestone County Courthouse, where he said the state is abusing his private property rights. This is much broader than my business transaction. That's taking people's property, Todd said during a radio interview in July. David Yuskowitz, TBWD's executive director, said in a July letter to Freestone County commissioners that the agency remains willing to negotiate with the new property owner and optimistic for a mutually beneficial outcome. If Todd interests don't agree to a sale, eminent domain experts say Texas can seize the land because the property serves a public purpose as a park. Andrew Morris, a Texas A&M law professor who specializes in eminent domain, said the first step would be a petition for condemnation filed in a Freestone County court, which would then appoint a panel of local landowners tasked with setting a fair market value for the property. The state would have to pay that amount for the land. Either party could appeal the valuation and leave the final decision on the price to a judge. In this case, it's definitely better to be Parks and Wildlife than the developer, Morris said. Eminent domain is, in general, pretty favorable to the condemning agency. Welcoming more than 80,000 visitors in 2022, the Fairfield Lake State Park is known for its towering elm, pecan, and ash trees, as well as its lake that drew anglers trying to catch catfish, largemouth bass, and other fish. The battle over the park's ownership has been brewing for years. The park opened in 1976 on land the state leased from the energy company Vistra Corp at no charge. Since then, the state said it has invested about $80 million into renovations and improvements to the park. In 2018, Vistra shut down the coal-fired power plant it operated across the lake from the park and notified TPWD that it planned to sell the property and terminate the state's lease. The state hoped to buy only the 1,820 acres that included the park. Vistra, which didn't want to sell the land in parts, said it encouraged the state to submit a bid to buy the entire property, but the state did not. In February, Vistra announced that it planned to sell the property to Todd Interests for $110,500,000. As visitors said their goodbyes on the park's last day, TPWD and lawmakers at the Capitol scrambled to try to save the park. In May, Parks and Wildlife offered Todd Interests $25 million to give up the company's contract so the state could purchase the property directly from Vistra. But the company declined, saying in a letter to the agency that the company has spent millions of dollars in due diligence and months of planning. The public battle over the land has seen Todd question TPWD's authority to use eminent domain and accuse the chair of the Texas Park and Wildlife Commission, Arch H. Beaver Appen III, who is the founder and president of Texas-based Buc-ee's Stores, of abusing his authority. Buc-ee's Beaver's restrooms might be clean, but I'm going to tell you this. Applin's leadership and his appointed leadership is dirty, and he is absolutely wiping private property rights away in his room, Todd said during a radio interview in July. Morris, the Texas A&M law professor, said Todd's arguments would be great arguments to make to the legislature to change eminent domain law, but I don't think they work as a legal argument to stop the state doing what it has the power to do. Freestone County commissioners have sided with Todd Interests and sent a letter in June to the state calling the use of eminent domain an abuse of power and government overreach. At a meeting in July, County Commissioner Lloyd Lane said Parks and Wildlife looks a little greedy for wanting to seize the former park property. He said Todd's proposed development could bring an estimated $20 million of annual tax revenue to the county and the school district. I hate for us to miss out on a tax base, and I hate for us to see a violation of property rights, Lane said at the meeting. Yosowitz, the TPWD executive director, responded to the letter in July, saying he was taken aback by the commissioner's dramatic change in position after their initial report to save the park. He wrote that the agency's vote to seize the land was done reluctantly, knowing that these types of actions should be used sparingly. Fort Worth native Misty Little, who visited the park as a child each spring and biked along its nature trails, is now a member of the Save Fairfield Lake State Park group. She said Todd's ongoing construction is causing environmental damage that can't be easily repaired. We are concerned that Todd's interest is going to make it much harder for Texas parks and wildlife to recover from this, Little said. You can't get rare prairies back or old growth forests back. That's the aggravating part. Heat wave tests the stamina, resourcefulness at major Southern youth baseball event. Ruston, Louisiana. With field temperatures soaring above 150 degrees at times, 10-year-old baseball player Emmett Anderson and his teammates from Alabama thought better of kneeling when they gathered near the mound for pregame prayers at a recent regional youth baseball tournament here. It was too hot on our knees, Anderson said of the artificial surface. We just stood up. High heat proved considerably harder to handle than fastballs up in the strike zone at the DYB World Series this week. Temperatures reached 105 degrees, with the heat index topping out at 117. Some spectators and umpires required treatment for heat-related symptoms. A few passed out and were briefly hospitalized. The heat was so extreme, I just knew it was a matter of time before something happened, said Dr. Kelsey Steensland, an anesthesiologist from Alabama who was there to watch her 10-year-old son, Finn, play for a team representing their state. During opening ceremonies, she rushed to help an elderly woman who collapsed and didn't regain consciousness for several minutes. This was a medical emergency, Steensland said. It was more than just giving someone a glass of water. With climate change driving average global temperatures higher, organizers, players, and spectators taking part in quintessentially American traditions, such as Midsummer Youth Baseball Championships, are having to pay closer attention to the heat and become more resourceful about mitigating its effects. A case in point is the DYB World Series, which features teams from 11 southern states competing in multiple age groups up to 12 years old. Formerly known as Dixie Youth Baseball, DYB was established in 1955. The number one priority to any event that anybody puts on outdoors is the safety and health of the participants, DYB Commissioner William Wade said. We've got to do the best we can to preach whatever safety we can. Large evaporator coolers, which pull air over water to cool it before blowing it back out, were placed in dugouts. It was the first time B.J. Brannigan, who coached a team from the New Orleans area, had ever seen that. During the first 4 days of the six-day tournament, when temperatures were hottest, games were halted every two innings for five-minute heat breaks. Cases of water were supplied to coaches, players, and umpires. Many also wore wet cooling towels on the back of their necks. Sail shades over the stands helped keep fans out of direct sunlight at the Ruston Sports Complex, a newly built facility that drew widespread praise from tournament participants and attendees. But some expressed concern over the way the artificial turf fields infilled with black rubber pellets for cushioning became so hot at times that one could easily see air rippling from convection just above the surface. One day they advised us that the temperature was 167 on the field, and it felt like it, umpire Ted Ward said, noting that he'd never been so hot in 25 years of calling balls and strikes. You couldn't stand still. You had to keep moving or your shoes would start getting soft on the bottom and the heat was radiating up into you. Ward was behind home plate that day, wearing a mask and chest protector, and passed out between innings. When he regained consciousness, he was being treated in the dugout and was taken soon after by ambulance to a hospital. He missed one day of games and returned to umpire again before the tournament ended. Any proposal to cancel or postpone the tournament would have been met with considerable opposition. It was getting close to the start of the school year for some players, and these were their highest stakes games of the season. Parents and grandparents had booked hotels and traveled from as far as Virginia. Spectators tried to adapt on the fly. Many showed up with hand-pulled wagons to move newly purchased lithium-ion battery-powered misting fans to seating areas where they were rigged to buckets of water. I've never experienced any kind of heat like this before. You can feel your eyes drying out, said Steensland, who watched the games with a misting fan pointed at her and her seven-month-old daughter. You're either prepared or you're not, she said, and the people that come prepared have a wagon full of hundreds of dollars of equipment. Chairs, fans, tents. You have to have industrial-grade fans to get through temperatures like this. Experts say heat exhaustion and heat stroke are likely to become more common in coming decades. Signs of heat illness include heavy sweating, dizziness, muscle spasms, nausea, and loss of consciousness. One of the more common ways people die from extreme heat is cardiovascular collapse because of the extra energy the heart expends to help the body respond. Dr. Jonathan Scott, an obstetrician from Dotham, said he treated a grandmother who passed out from the heat in the stands near him. People sitting nearby caught her in time to prevent her from falling. They cooled her down with ice, and she came to pretty quickly for us, he said. This is the hottest any of us can remember, said Scott, whose 10-year-old son Davis is an outfielder. Scott purchased and set up two large misting fans to augment four handheld fans he already had. He also bought 5 gallons of ice water to get through the games. Still, Scott said his clothes were soaked through from sweat when games ended. Kevin Murphy, the father of a 12-year-old player from Livingston, Texas, called the heat during the tournament brutal. To combat it, he had a device that pulled air through a cooler full of ice and blew it out through a flexible tube. He said he'd been using it regularly at games in Texas as well. Rain, shine, hot, snow, whatever it takes, Murphy said. We're going to be here watching these kids, and they're going to be out there playing. They love it. During opening ceremonies, the featured guest speaker was Louisiana Tech baseball coach Lane Burrows, who tried to mentally prepare players and their families by noting, "It's August in Louisiana. We're going to have to dominate those elements, won't we?" Casey Anderson, Emmett's father, smiled as he recalled that pep talk. "I don't know about dominating," he said, "more like enduring and surviving." But parents and coaches said they heard virtually no complaints from the kids, who seemed thrilled to have a chance to end their season at the marquee event of every DYB season. "They were champs about it," Brannigan said. "The hardest part was keeping the kids from wanting to go back on the field before the 5-minute heat breakup was. We just preached fluids. Stay by the cool air from the evaporator cooler, put the cooling towels on you, and take advantage of the 5-minute break," Brannigan said. "That was as much as we could do to guard against the heat." Pleasant Farms man arrested in wife's death. A Pleasant Farms man has been arrested in the death of his wife. According to Ector County Sheriff's Office, deputies were notified about an ambulance call in the 16,000 block of Snow Moon around 7 a.m. Saturday, and when they arrived, they found Lisa Clark Miller, 58, dead, and Michael Brian Miller, 56, unconscious. Michael Miller was taken to Medical Center Hospital, but later arrested on suspicion of murder and booked into the Ector County Jail. Sheriff Mike Griffiths said it appears as though Lisa Miller was beaten, but the exact cause of death won't be known until an autopsy is performed. Michael Miller's brother called 911 to report his brother had been texting him crazy stuff and indicated he was going to commit suicide, Griffiths said.
Hi, I am continuing the Midland Reporter Telegram for August 12, 2023. In Dear Abby, 6 years on, widow can't let go of husband. Dear Abby, I have a dear friend whose husband passed away 6 years ago. They had a 45-year marriage with plenty of ups and downs. She's 81 and in excellent health. You would think she was 60 if you met her. She's very youthful and full of energy. The problem is, when I'm with her, she constantly talks about her late husband as if he's still with us. Oh, Joe would love this. Joe always said, Joe would say, etc. During one luncheon, she mentioned him 20 times as if he were sitting with us. In retrospect, her marriage now seems to have become the greatest love story ever told, and Joe has risen to sainthood. It's unnerving. Is this healthy behavior? It seems excessive to me. On the anniversary of his death, she says she's going to stay home and be with Joe, which translates to her being at home alone, becoming depressed and crying. I hear how sad and emotionally drained she is afterward. I'm at a loss about what to do, if anything. I offer a sympathetic ear, but should I say anything to her? And if so, what? She has a grief counselor, and I'm wondering if he's really helping her move forward. My friend seems stuck in the role of grieving widow. I don't mean to be insensitive to losing a life partner, but I worry about her mental state. Please advise what I can say or do to help her. Doesn't seem normal in California. Dear Doesn't, I am relatively new to the grieving experience, having lost my husband 3.5 years ago, but allow me to share some insight. The adage that there is no timetable for grieving is accurate. Some widows and widowers are able to move on quickly. For others, it takes a long time for the ache to subside when their spouse pops into their consciousness every day. If your friend needs to idealize her up and down 45-year marriage, please don't rain on her parade. Let her enjoy the fantasy, if it is one. And when you know she's going to be depressed and crying on those milestone anniversaries, ask her out to lunch or dinner so she won't be as isolated as she feels. If necessary, tell her that after such a great loss, it's no wonder she's feeling awful and she should mention it to her therapist. Dear Abby, in lieu of a regular pizza night, some good friends invited my wife and me to join them at a high-end restaurant. We agreed. We had a good dinner and an enjoyable evening. When our separate checks arrived, our friends paid theirs with a gift card. Ours was a Whopper, and the reason they wanted to eat there became quite obvious. I was annoyed because I felt our friends should have applied their gift card to the entire bill, and we would then split it. My wife says we had a nice evening, and I shouldn't feel miffed, but I still think we were treated poorly. What are your thoughts about this? Hefty Bill in the South. Dear Hefty Bill, it would have been gracious for your friends to have applied the gift card universally. However, the two of you are good friends with this couple. You had a nice time and enjoyed your meal. This is not something worth nursing a grudge over, so let it go.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.